Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, we're really, really excited to have Mad Jensen with us. Mad is a managing partner at Superseed, which is a venture fund focused on SaaS and AI startups and helping B2B businesses accelerate to their first million in revenue. Mad, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
No problem. So let's jump straight in. I'm really intrigued around your journey. So you started off early days in IBM and then founded your own startup. So it'd be really good to understand kind of what led you to move from like, you know, a corporate behemoth like IBM to Sapphira, your own startup, and actually, you know, specifically launching that in 2009, straight on the coattails of the global financial crisis. You know, what were the challenges from that? What drove you to it? What were the challenges? It'd be great to understand that.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Arish. So really good question. I've always wanted to build a tech company. I got my first computer when I was 6 and fell madly in love with technology. And I always sort of thought, you know, that's my passion. That's where I want to spend my time. And I came really close to starting a software company back in 2000, 2001, around the time when I was finishing university. At the time, I was building a small business, a startup with some engineers, some engineering friends and software developers. And we had an offer for some pre-seed funding. And do you know what? I didn't feel ready at the time. Startup culture wasn't nearly as developed back then as it is today. And I sort of thought, look, let me go and learn what tech is really about, what it's like to run and build a tech business. And so what was the biggest tech business at the time was IBM. So I'm like, great. I've got to have an opportunity to go there and learn about technology and about tech business. And that's what I did. And fast forward, I sort of thought, you know, I'll spend 3 years there, 4 years learning the ropes. I ended up staying there 5 years, 6 years. So after 7 years, I'm like, gosh, I really wanted to start that software company. I better get moving. Otherwise, I'll end up staying here forever. And I made the jump initially first to Fontainebleau in France, where I went to do an MBA. I was there for a year. And after that, launched Sapphira with a good friend and co-founder. And we built the company up over 7 years and exited in 16. And so in terms of sort of, you know, the timing and the challenges, 2009, you're absolutely right. It was a bit of a crazy time, but I think we thought about it mainly as an opportunity. It was sort of Web 2.0 was just taking off. Cloud computing, AWS was all the rage. This was so exciting. And we sort of thought, look, the space we were in, it was a space we termed high performance building design, which was around helping architects and engineers build better buildings. And that's a very complex process. You have to do lots of sort of simulation, sort of physics based simulation to understand how buildings perform, sort of with thermal flows, you know, energy, daylight, all that stuff. And nobody had ever really done that on the cloud before. So we were like virgin territory, right? Amazing. We can do this on the cloud. We can be pioneers. We can do real-time simulation. And so we were really excited by that. I think in terms of challenges, venture was nascent in the UK. It was hard to raise money. We ended up raising money mainly from US investors. And actually, Sapphira became quite quickly sort of a US company. I ended up spending, you know, probably half of my time over the following 6 years in the US to build up the business. But in terms of the timing, I mean, it was great. It was a land of opportunity, and there was a lot of talent moving out of financial services at that time. So we were able to set up in New York and get, you know, great software developers coming up from Wall Street that were tired of working in the banks, or, you know, the banks were downsizing or whatever. So we could get really good talent. So we felt that the timing was great, actually, and very exciting.
So that actually raises a really interesting point, because I mean, I get approached a lot and asked, you know, how do I get into startups, or is it worth joining a startup, or, you know, from a career perspective, what should I do? And it strikes me that probably back in those days, you know, the typical journey was join a larger corporate and then kind of, you know, learn the skills, you know, that you needed to run a business, let's say, and then move in startups. Whereas now that's kind of turned on its head. There's almost like a stigma around joining a big corporate. And, you know, the first choice when you're, you know, straight out of university, or maybe you've come out of INSEAD as you did, is to go and build a startup straight off the bat without necessarily having had the experience. Just out of interest, like if you look back then and look at now, do you think that that is a reasonable progression that we've gone through? Is it as important to get that kind of fundamental business learning and structural learning under a larger corporate, you know, like IBM or like Microsoft or any others? Or do you think it's now entirely valid to skip that whole kind of, you know, that whole kind of rite of passage and move straight into startups?
Oh, without a doubt. I think sort of two things have happened. So first of all, I think we've gotten a better understanding of how important startups are for the economy and what they can become and how many of them we can build. And I think a better understanding of how much this really is the future. Just kind of, you know, go back sort of 20 years. I think there's a part of me was probably thinking, you know, Microsoft's already been built, right? Are there going to be any other big software company? Like Microsoft is already there, right? IBM's already there. Whereas today we know, you know, gosh, there's going to be unicorns, new unicorns born every month. So I think we have a much better understanding now of the potential of technology. But the other thing is it's also because the ecosystem is bigger, it's much easier to learn in many ways because there's so many people who have been there before. The venture ecosystem is more developed. There are things like, you know, seed and pre-seed. You can raise pre-seed money, right? You can go join accelerators like or incubators like Antler and EF. There's so many avenues today that can allow you to learn and develop the skills either, you know, by founding a startup, by joining a team. So I'd say without a doubt, that game has changed completely from what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I definitely echo that. Like, I think the wrong reasons to join a startup are, you know, because you think it's cool. The right reasons are to learn because you get a hell of a lot of learning in a very condensed kind of period of time. Moving back to kind of Sapphira, one of the things that I'd really like to understand, obviously, you know, I'm a finance geek, I guess, but, you know, startups aren't always only about finance, right? So what were the kind of key metrics, or what is the one thing that you guys would track outside the, you know, the table stakes of revenue or, you know, recurring revenue? What was the kind of the North Star for the business from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, revenue is a lagging indicator. The leading indicator is usage. It's, you know, customers engaging with your product and loving it. And so one of the extremely exciting things about Web 2.0 and cloud computing was suddenly we had metrics, right? Prior to that, you'd have software, people would download it, install it locally, and you kind of wouldn't necessarily really know what was happening. But suddenly we could see everything that was happening. And this was sort of, you drink from the fire hose. And so we spent a lot of time instrumenting the software, building traps and everywhere so we could see everything that was going on. And, you know, fast forward, you know, 10 years to today, you know, the world is much more sophisticated about it than we were back then. But I think back then we were just really, really excited that we could see the engagement and trying to understand how people engage. And we obsessed over that.
Yeah, I think, again, it's the one thing that founders talk about, but maybe forget along the way. Your product is nothing without your users, without your customers, right? So if you're creating value for them and if they're really engaged, then that's telling you you're doing something completely the right way, right? So if you were to look back to then, knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently? Or what is the key lesson that I think you've learned having been through that process? Or what would you have done differently?
It's almost embarrassing to say it. So the one piece of advice that you always, you know, you always get, and it's the advice we always give founders. And yet we committed the same cardinal sin of really lacking focus. I mean, we felt we were focused, but in retrospect, we were trying to do way too much. And so I remember after we raised our Series A, we felt, we've got all this money in the bank, all this, you know, it's endless, right? We could do all this stuff. And we sort of quite quickly found ourselves building four different product lines all at once. And we were doing nowhere. You know, we were just not ready to do that. So that was an expensive, costly mistake we made. And we had to backtrack and close things. And, you know, actually had to do quite a lot of layoffs at a point where we'd been trying to do too much. And of course, there are two sides of it, right? You burn through resources too quickly and you dilute your focus too much. And so you don't make as much progress with the things that really matter. So the one thing I would do differently today would be laser focus. And yeah, it's not very profound, but I think it's very important.
Again, couldn't agree more. I had a call this morning with two young co-founders. They're currently at kind of grad school and they want to build like an entire ecosystem play and solve multiple different pain points, which are currently being solved individually. And I sort of said to them, listen, guys, like you run the risk effectively of building nothing of value because you're trying to build everything, right? So if you just find the one pain point that you know is solvable and has a real kind of, you know, solves a real problem for a customer, then, you know, from there you can build on that, right? You can build features, but, you know, don't try and build everything today because you're just going to end up diluting focus, as you said, and not actually providing value anywhere. So moving kind of on to investments. So prior to Superseed, you were with CapEx. So what led you after kind of exiting the business? Did you want to get into finance and get into venture? Was that the natural step? I mean, a lot of people get the sort of serial bug and want to just launch, you know, multiple startups. But it, you know, it sounds like you kind of had done your thing, had scratched that itch around building the startup and then moved into venture. Is that fair? Or was there a more kind of nuanced decision-making process from your side?
I love building things. I love being a founder and building product and building an organization, team, you know, customers. I think that's amazing. I've always loved finance. So when I went to university, I felt I already knew computers. So I went to study business and finance, and then that, you know, first in business school. And then later on, I took an MBA. So I've been through that road twice, and I've always loved finance as well. And I think, you know, tech and finance, the combination is really special. And so I think venture capital was kind of a natural next step for me. Also, building a startup is so challenging, and there are so many pitfalls. And I felt the best thing I could do was to try and help other founders, you know, build their companies and really leverage some of the lessons I've had. And no doubt, if I had set out to build another company, there would have been a lot of things that would be easier for me second time around. But I just felt, look, why not try and help, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 other teams? You know, I can augment the lessons I've had in a much better way. So it felt like a very natural progression.
And at Superseed, you guys are super hands-on, right? To the extent that you go out, you look for customers, you introduce customers to your portfolio companies. So just talk me through that, because I mean, that's a lot of overhead for a venture firm to take on, right? Because we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of users or customers here. We're talking about enterprise customers, which, you know, are very hard to kind of penetrate. So is that the philosophy at Superseed? Is the hands-on element of it because you know that pain point, or what drives that from your perspective?
So we invest in founding teams and startups at the seed stage when they've developed technology that's differentiated, has got global potential, and where we think this is just something that's unique and that can become a really big and exciting thing. And when you're at that stage, you need to commercialize. And that's often the hardest step for founders, especially technical founders. You know, if you've never really sold, if you've never really built out a sales team, you know, thinking through how you built your commercial model can be really, really tricky. And so we think that stage from seed to series A, when you go from having a product, but not having customers, to having enough customers that you sort of you've proven your model, is super exciting. But it's also super challenging. And we just think we can add a lot of value there by working with founders. And all companies are different. All founding teams are different. But some things that they have in common is, you know, we kind of the necessity to position your business really well, to think about who you are and what you're trying to do. Is it really the core identity? Really nailing your ideal customer profile. And then following that, going out and finding prospects that match that profile. And that we have a whole system and a team that's set up to do that. And I think because we've become quite good at doing that, we've leveraged our own sales learning from the past, and we've found a way to sort of repeat that across our startups. That means we can quickly open doors for many prospective customers and help the founders we work with get lots of feedback from the market and win business. And we just think it's a win-win for everybody. So yeah, it takes, you know, time and effort and resource, but we think it pays back in spades for everybody.
So it goes beyond capital, starts becoming capital as a service, I guess. Seeing a lot of that, you know, we talked recently to Kevin Montserrat from Consilience Ventures, who built out like an expert network, which is core to their kind of offering in terms of the fund. I think, as you say, as venture becomes ubiquitous, i.e. there's a lot of capital in the markets, but equally as, you know, the ability to start to launch and scale, you know, a business becomes easier, you know, between various cloud services, platforms, no code, et cetera, that actually that value add beyond just the capital is super important, I think, to founders. They're looking for smart money, not, you know, not just the money. And one of the things I actually wanted to ask you was, you know, why B2B? Because B2B, I think, is the less sexy part of venture, if I can put it that way. Everyone's always interested in the next kind of massive consumer play, and you've got all these sort of B2B businesses sitting in the background. They don't get kind of much press, but they're, you know, they're exiting at 10-figure valuations and beyond. I mean, why B2B? What is it about B2B that really gets you guys going at Superseed?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You know, my wife is in advertising, and she always teases me, right? With sort of, I invest in sort of that boring stuff nobody's heard about. And yes, I mean, there is something in that. I guess if you boil it down, sort of really simply, you can think of B2B often being mainly sales driven and B2C often being mainly marketing driven. And so, you know, by nature, are you more of a marketing kind of person or are you more of a sales kind of person? And so a lot of the DNA at Superseed and a lot of what we do is build up around sales, sales execution, sales organizations, understanding what does it take to sell and do that successfully. There is also a need for marketing. It's probably more around brand marketing than some of the programmatic, you know, coin operated marketing, but sales is really in the focus. If you take one step back, there is perhaps a wider reason for why we find B2B so interesting, because B2B is really about understanding business processes and understanding how improving those business processes can help you unlock ROI. And that's a skill. And that's something that I've spent my whole life doing. I did that at IBM. I did that at Sapphira. I'm doing this with all our portfolio companies every day. And the same for everybody else at Superseed. We have been in B2B forever. That's all we've done. Like literally none of us, I think, have, you know, maybe somebody has ventured into consumer for a year or 6 months and then run screaming away. But we are really, we're business process people. So we can add a lot of value, I think, to the founders we sit down with, because we have seen so many situations in B2B because it's just what we've done, you know, our whole careers. And so, you know, I love it. I love working with founders to help them figure out how can they really unlock value? How should they go to market? What is the ideal customer profile really? And that touches on everything, you know, both on how they build out their sales organization to how they think about their product roadmap to, dare I say it, even their marketing strategy. So we see things through that lens and I think we've become quite good at it. And so, you know, you should do the things, you know, that, you know, where you have a competitive advantage and where you can add real value. And that's what we try to do.
Yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense. You're all specialists within that kind of broad church of B2B and therefore can add value across the whole spectrum. In fact, you know, one of the questions I had is, what is it? And it's funny because you half touched on it. What is it that you look for in the ventures that you guys back? Is it the team? Is it the market? Is it the traction? Like, what is most important to Superseed? But just as you were talking, I also realized that that is an impossible question because it kind of depends on the business. But I mean, if there were one thing, what would it be that you guys have to have in that business before you'll back it above and beyond anything else?
Yeah, in team, market, and traction, we shouldn't forget tech. I mean, tech is important. We are tech investors at the end of the day. I think, you know, we are looking for incredible teams that build things in attractive markets at the end of the day. And we've got to convince ourselves that the team we are sitting in front of are these great, ambitious entrepreneurs that have what it takes to go the whole way and that they're operating in markets that can become really exciting. And I think this is sort of back to the question from before around sort of business processes and understanding how business operates. Having worked in large corporates and mid-sized corporates and small corporates and have all that experience about, you know, what is it really like on the other side, I think can help us a lot when we understand businesses, because understanding the companies we invest in is a lot about understanding their customers, sort of the whole value chain. And that's what we try to do every time we sit down with a startup.
Yeah, I was going to ask you kind of as operators, how does that change your approach to investing? You've talked a lot about kind of that already, but do you think that it gives you an angle that others, just pure kind of, let's say, money managers, you know, does it give you an edge over those sort of investors? Or can it equally be a bit of a hindrance because you have slight tunnel vision around, you know, what you've seen and what you think works? Because, you know, I often find that it's, you know, you've got to be able to see beyond what you know to be able to back the next, you know, really great business, because ultimately it could be doing something you would have never anticipated, right? Or isn't even right for today, but might be right for tomorrow.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's the biggest risk. Right. It's that you get sort of, you get blinded a bit by, oh, we've seen 10 of those already. And if you sort of don't stop and reflect on, well, what is it that's different here? And could the fact that those other 10, they didn't come good, but maybe they've just unlocked the one thing now that means that this time it's going to be, you got to be able to approach every new opportunity, every new team you meet with fresh eyes. And that is, I think, probably the hardest part of the job, if I can call it that. I mean, some people say it's not really a job. And I have some sympathy with that. It's a privilege, right, to do what we do. But how does it change? There is a lot of value in being a savvy and strong financial investor. There's some very successful VCs that come from a financial background, no doubt. And I think we look at everything we see through an operator lens in building the business. You know, we try and figure out, you know, how is this team practically going to go about finding customers, deliver ROI, scale, you know, and then connect the nuts and bolts to the big picture and back again. And I think we sort of feel that our operating experience gives us a way of doing that probably is hard if you haven't been in the trenches. There's another aspect of it, which I think is the fact that we've been in the trenches maybe means we can empathize with our founders differently to people who have never been there. And it probably helps us maybe build some trust more quickly. It means we can maybe partner with teams in a different way to somebody who's never been there. So I think it helps us in that sense. At the end of the day, the thing we always have to remind ourselves is, you know, it's not what we can do with the business. It's what the founders are going to do with the business. So we invest in teams, we back teams. We're not trying to run the business from the backseat or anything like that. It's about helping them. They're the stars of the show. We're just there in the wings trying to figure out whatever they need to shine. That's what we're there to help get to them.
That's awesome. One of the things that I think about when I'm thinking about B2B is like, for a B2B business to be successful, you've got to either save time or save money, right? At its very simplest, that's basically what you're trying to do. You're trying to replace a process that is really not time efficient, or you're trying to save, you know, a team of money. But over the last year and a half, obviously with COVID, with the pandemic, businesses have had to really kind of just change the way they do lots of things. So it'd be really great to understand from you, what are the current trends that you're sort of seeing within B2B? Because I have a feeling that it's probably gone beyond the pure save time and save money. And it's actually a restructuring of how businesses even think about how they operate. Would that be fair to say?
Look, we're just at the beginning of a massive change of how everything works in business. The pace of change is accelerating. You know, we are only getting started on automating and improving what we do to business. You know, we have autonomous systems cropping up, you know, everywhere being built. We have quantum computing right around the corner, which is going to unleash a whole new wave of innovation. I mean, it's so exciting. We see decades of innovation ahead. But touching on the pandemic and touching on what's happening globally right now, kind of the big macro trends are sort of it's the pandemic and it's, you know, US versus China, right? It's kind of, it's the whole, we've had sort of 30 years of offshoring, of moving manufacturing to other parts of the world. And that was just about labor arbitrage. And to some extent, that is, we're now coming to the end of that S curve, right? Most of the gains have been had. So businesses, they need to keep getting better, but they can't do that mindlessly by just moving things to low, you know, destinations with low labor costs. So what is the next natural thing? Well, it's automation. And automation will give us a number of things. It'll give us an opportunity to, I think, reshore parts of our manufacturing base. We can do that because it'll no longer be just about, oh, can we compete on, you know, the minimum wage or the price per hour? But who is better at automation? Who is better at being really innovative about how we can make things? We're so excited about what's ahead there. So yeah, and the pandemic, the disruption to supply chains is just helping to sort of catalyze that change. So we see opportunity everywhere in this value chain.
That's amazing. But the flip side of that is there's also a huge amount of capital floating around. So, I mean, you know, how would you talk about the state of the venture ecosystem? Because we have large swathes of capital coming in from the US now. There's just, you know, emerging fund managers, you know, cropping up everywhere. How do you see the state of that ecosystem? Because as you have more capital, you have more potential ventures, but equally you're seeing pricing going through the roof, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how do you cope in that environment as well? What is your position there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are in the most exciting part of the venture ecosystem because this is where sort of new businesses are funded and created and growing. And you're absolutely right. Lots of capital has been coming into the ecosystem. A lot of it has been coming in at later stages. If you look at the number of seed stage deals that are done, they're actually declining year on year in the last few years in the UK. So we see fewer transactions, larger, but fewer. And what's interesting is we see, you know, great founding teams still today that are having a really hard time getting funded and getting off the ground. And sometimes it's natural. It takes time for teams to figure out, you know, make the pivots and figure out what is it really they should be and find the right customer sets. So they may not be completely ready to raise yet. And sometimes it's good to be going through that process, but we just see the fact that there's more capital as something that will hopefully help catalyze the ecosystem to develop more funding options, right? So maybe a business is not ready for seed, but maybe it's a pre-seed, or maybe it's an incubator program, or maybe it's something else that will help that team, that idea mature and move on. And you know, the more founders we can get in to solve the biggest challenges of the world, the better. So we're excited about it, but we haven't really sort of seen any negative side effects in our segment of the space from the capital yet. Are there silly things that get funded? Undoubtedly. And I think it was always thus, right? You go back, you know, 25 years, the dot-com boom, there were crazy things that were funded, but there were also some amazing things that were funded, right? And many of the greatest businesses we have today, the company like Amazon, came out of that era. And so I think it'll be like that today. There will be lots of silly checks written, and amongst that, there will be lots of gems. And, you know, we just hope we can be good enough to partner with some of the gems that will become, you know, the champions of tomorrow.
I think that's a great philosophy to have. And I think I would echo everything you said there. More capital hopefully means more innovation. More innovation means more opportunity. More opportunity means more innovation, means more capital. And it's hopefully a self-fulfilling cycle that just keeps kind of driving everything towards, you know, hopefully better value throughout the system. So Mads, it's been absolutely incredible speaking to you today. Thank you so much for your time. Where can our listeners find you? Are you on LinkedIn, on Twitter? Where's the best place to look for you?
At LinkedIn is always good. Yeah, look us up there. I'm active. Others from the team are even more active, and we always love to engage in a good discussion about startups and the future of innovation.
That's excellent. So look, thank you so much, Mads. I really appreciate your time. Have a great day ahead.
Arish, thanks for having us. It was a great pleasure to be here, and thanks for having us on the show.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?